Hi everyone and welcome in this new episode of 20 Minutes pour Comprendre, the podcast which aims to help you understand international relations. As our listeners have noticed, we will not talk in French today, but like it's the third episode of our partnership with the EUV project, I have the great pleasure and honor to receive today Alfred Gerstel. Good morning.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. So you're a political scientist specialized on the Indo-Pacific and especially Southeast Asia. You work a lot on interesting topics, Belt and Road Initiative, aging strategies. We won't cover them today. We have no time.
Yes.
But we'll talk about another of your like main topics, which is ASEAN.
That's
and
right,
I'm yeah. really glad to do so because we haven't talked one time about it in the podcast, so it will
then
be...
It's about time.
Yes. And it will be... Your presence is really helpful, so thank you. And you're also head of the EU-funded UVIP project,
yes.
And president of the Central European Institute of Asian Studies based in Bratislava.
Right, yes.
So, sir, can you give us, first of all, a brief overview of the background of the ASEAN? For example, when did it emerge, why, and who are its maybe founding members?
Well, there's a very specific date when ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, was established. This was on 8 August 1967, and the five founding members were Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand. However, of course, there were years, if not decades, of previous cooperation between certain Southeast Asian nations, and we have to go back even a bit further into history. And I would say, let's start after the Second World War, because at this time, the Southeast Asian nations, with the exception of Thailand, were still colonies.
Mm-hmm.
And after 45, that was when Japan had, within the Second World War, conquered almost all of Southeast Asia, again with the exception of Thailand. So Japan was retreating from Southeast Asia, and the Western colonial powers tried to reclaim their territories, their colonial possessions in Southeast Asia. Of course, the Southeast Asian countries were not happy about this, so we also had colonial wars. Especially brutal were the fights in Indonesia and Vietnam. That is, of course, mm-hmm. something, or that in Indochina in particular, that is, of course, something very much related to France. And it took some time until the Southeast Asian nations became independent, some of them peacefully, luckily, that's Malaysia and Singapore. Others had to fight for the independence, mm-hmm. just mentioned, especially Vietnam and Indonesia. In the early 50s, the countries started to try to cooperate with each other. But at this time, there were also some conflicts among them, border issues, and also distrust, which not least dated back to the colonial times. So it was really the first time in the 50s, early 60s, that they started to view the region, Southeast mm-hmm. Asia, as a common area where you resolve problems, where you talk to each other, where you have common challenges, but also opportunities. And for this, they established regional institutions, and the most promising one was ASEAN, mm-hmm. established, as already said, in 1967.
And so the real objective of ASEAN, at least at that time, is to help those countries cooperate, is that so?
Yes, that's correct. In fact, there are a couple of, let's say, yes, outspoken motives mm-hmm. and hidden ones. A key motive for the five ASEAN founding members was to insulate themselves from great power mm-hmm. policies, because it was still
the Cold
not
War.
The colonial yeah. war, especially the Cold War was looming, so China was not clear mm-hmm. which position it will take, the Soviet Union, US. And here the aim was, if we stand together, the five of us, we do have more influence, leverage in international politics than small Singapore mm-hmm. alone. And please also keep in mind, Singapore today, it's a country has a much higher GDP than Belgium
yes.
or Czech Republic. But this wasn't the case in the 50s, 60s. It was really a poor developing countries. Same applies for the other countries. So their influence in global politics or geoeconomics mm-hmm. was very low.
Okay.
Together, of course, it was much higher. So this was one aim, to speak with one voice to US, to China, Soviet Union, and so on. And the other one was indeed to cooperate with each other. And one motive, I would also say it's almost, sounds strange, but it was a negative motive, because at this time there was so much distrust between the countries. We had the so-called Konfrontasi policy of Indonesia, which was directed against Malaysia. Singapore was regarded critical also by some neighbors. Philippines was regarded as being too close to the United States. So they needed a forum to come together and discuss, also behind closed doors, some bilateral or trilateral issues and try to build trust. And what's the easiest way? If you start cooperating in fields of law politics, that's economics, cultural, and once you have established this kind of trust,
you can go further.
You can go further. So that's the classic theory of neo-functionalism.
Yes, exactly.
And ASEAN, in fact, is a case that it works.
Yeah. Okay, great. And I think for our European listeners, there's like a comparison to make here, because
we are talking about
countries that are sticking together first, because to try to make a place on the international stage and to build trust. So we won't talk a lot about European Union. It's not the purpose, but its evolution has been made on like two legs, enlargement and integrations. Is it the same for ASEAN, or is it, like always in international relations, more complicated than that? So,
easy answer, yes. Second answer, yes, more complicated. Of course. Yeah. Well, if you look especially what happened in the early 90s, after the end of the Cold War, definitely we also see the pattern of enlargement and deepening. And let me also add 1967, one motive we have addressed, it was, of course, the Cold War situation.
Yes.
So the five founding ASEAN members were pro-Western. They were not democratic countries, but they were pro-Western and strict anti-communist. So Vietnam, of course,
was a big issue.
A threat, was really regarded as a threat. And what happened after the Cold War in 1995, Vietnam joined ASEAN, and this was really a strong message. So for Southeast Asia, it's the end of Cold War. We really try to accommodate Vietnam. We cooperate with Vietnam closely. And there were no fears anymore that a communist country would join and would spread the communist ideology in the other parts of Southeast Asia. No, it was really a very pragmatic cooperation. But already in the 90s, one motive for admitting Vietnam was the looming risk of China. So it was
already
not clear already in the 90s. So it was not fully clear what's the Chinese leadership up to, because in the 90s, we, like in Europe, we saw the economic opportunities. But in Southeast Asia in particular, but also Australia, there was much more focus on the military. So the investments of China, the military upgrades. So there were also the time, it's so-called China threat debate. We have a similar debate today. So history repeats itself quite often. But the neighbors in Southeast Asia were very much concerned. So that's why they liked Vietnam as partner. But at the same time, they also offered cooperation to China and made it in a manner that still applies. So there's also a pattern, because first of all, let me take one step back, because we talked about enlargement. Today, we have 11 countries in Southeast Asia and 10 are members of ASEAN, and they joined in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. The one exception missing is East Timor. It's interestingly, according to the Economist Democracy Index, for instance, it's the only full democracy in Southeast Asia.
Which is not in ASEAN.
Not yet, but this will happen in the next couple of years.
Okay.
So it is officially, everyone has agreed that East Timor will join, but the timetable is not yet fixed.
Okay.
So it could be 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, but on paper, we know East Timor will join. And then really all 11 Southeast Asian nations are member of ASEAN.
Okay.
So that's a very strong message. So in addition to enlargement, we have, as we said, same what the EU did.
Integration.
Deepening and really integration, especially in the realms of economics. So we have since 2015, officially ASEAN is called ASEAN Community. and it consists of three pillars. The first one is the ASEAN political security community. So we also see the parallels to the EU. We have the ASEAN economic community and we have the ASEAN social political community. Mm-hmm. And this is meant the civil society.
Okay,
it's pillar. It's also academic cooperation, mm-hmm. students exchange, everything like this is in this third pillar. The deepest cooperation, I would really speak of integration, certain areas that's in the economic pillar. So here the EU single market is the role model. Yeah. But for instance, unlike in the EU, there are no talks about an ASEAN common currency. There's also not a free movement of workers.
Like in Schengen space, for example.
There's no Schengen. It's easier to travel if you go to Southeast Asian interest. There's a specific line at the airports for ASEAN citizens, yes, but they still have to show their passport.
Yes.
So it's that's a big difference. And I don't think this will change likely. Also, so there we have the enlargement, we have the deepening, but there's still a huge difference between the EU and ASEAN because the EU is a supranational organization and ASEAN has no aspirations in transforming into one.
So it means that, for example, our listeners know that the European Union may create rules that are compulsory for its member states. It's not the same with ASEAN. Is that so?
There are certain rules and norms that, yes, they are compulsory, mm-hmm. yes, but, and this is one of the problems we have in ASEAN, but also in the ASEAN institutions that we see in the Indo-Pacific, mm-hmm. which we'll discuss in a few minutes. Yes, there are rules, there are certain decisions, but the problem is the enforcement. So if one member doesn't stick to it, there are no mechanisms in place. So there's no international court for Southeast Asia that actually says, okay, you didn't stick to the rule, now you have to pay this and this amount, or you really have, in the next 2 years, you have to implement it. There is even not much public criticism because the policy of naming and shaming a member, that's really a no-go in Southeast Asia.
It's maybe probably because those countries are still young, meaning they are still the produce, not the produce of colonization, but maybe of decolonization.
Yes.
And the idea of having like a supranational powers on you may be like complicated, maybe.
That's a very good interpretation, because if you look at the ASEAN Charter, so that's the founding document of ASEAN, there's really a strong emphasis on national sovereignty, mm-hmm. non-interference into domestic affairs, and also decision-making in Southeast Asia, Indo-Pacific, it's consensual bit.
Yes.
So unlike in the common foreign security policy we have in Europe, there's no majority voting.
Okay.
Because really, if there's an issue, and it happened quite often, that we have 10 members now in ASEAN, 9 members agree on a policy or decision, and one member says no, there's no way to force this member or actually have a majority voting, that the policy would be, okay, today we don't have a consensus, let's talk again in 3 months, and maybe in this time the other member changes or not. And if not, We'll talk again.
Yes.
And this is also a problem. Very often ASEAN has been criticized, not only from European diplomat sides, but also Japanese, for instance, that it's only a talk shop. Mm-hmm. So not able to make decisions or stick to it.
And we'll tackle this issue regarding foreign policy. But before that, is there like common policy on very specific issues? Where you, I guess, and you have mentioned the economy. But for example, before opening too much dossier, is there like a form of foreign policy, common foreign policy? There is a pillar.
Okay, there's a pillar. That's
effectively,
right. Yes.
Where is it?
Well, here, I think we shouldn't be too critical with ASEAN, because that's, I mean, many of my words are critical, of course, but if we talk about the EU, I would also be critical.
It's a big
problem,
you know.
Yes, that's right. That's right. You need many podcasts to discuss the EU. But I really want to highlight that if you made, a kind of ranking about regional organizations, and we do have many, and I think they're very, very useful, and we do need them. EU, of course, is the most deeply integrated one. But ASEAN is second on the list.
Yes.
So okay. It is in the global south. It's more, the most successful regional organization.
Yeah. So we are not here to make comparison or ranking, but for example, African Union is not the same.
No, it's not the same. It's okay. Not the same. It's, of course, there are also more members. It's But ASEAN, if you look at Southeast Asia, it's a very complex sub-region. So you have so many different languages, cultures, religions. So it's very similar to Africa. Yes. So it's not, so you, ASEAN's slogan is also, it's really bringing unity in a very mixed, very, in a region that is very heterogeneous. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now I propose to tackle some foreign policies issues. And we have already in the context of the UVIP project made a podcast about Myanmar, which is member, I think.
Of Myanmar ASEAN. Is a member, yes.
And we have seen that there has been a coup, and there also so there is lots of coup in Myanmar. But there have been a recent coup, 2021, but also the Rohingya genocide. What was the position of the ASEAN, if it there has been a position, since we have seen the complication about that?
Yes, and we really have to start that Myanmar is, of course, really dreadful example for violation of human rights, of basic human rights, of how the military regime treats its own people. So it's really shocking. To make it even more complicated, Myanmar has always been a thorn in the side of ASEAN, because it has been a military regime. Then, also, I was quite optimistic in the 2008. After 2008, there were really democratic reforms. Aung San Suu Kyi came to power. So there were some very positive sides. However, always in between, when there were coups, especially the Western countries were extremely critical of Myanmar, rightfully, but they were also extremely critical of ASEAN for not influencing or using their influence on Myanmar to change the situation. And while talking to diplomats in Southeast Asia, but also academics, they regard it as unfair, this kind of criticism. And the reason is they are very critical of the situation. And especially in the last year, countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore. But on the one hand side, they have the ASEAN, so-called ASEAN way norms, which means sovereignty, non-interference. So they're bounded by this kind of rules and guidelines. And on the other side, we do have to acknowledge that I think China is the only country in the world that has some influence on Myanmar right now.
Yes.
So this has been also explained by the Southeast Asian diplomats to the European colleagues. Look, we are critical behind the doors. We try our best, but we cannot change the situation.
It may also be like a little hypocritical, because in European Union, we haven't the influence to change Hungary or Poland policies regarding human rights. So it's not the same situation as in Myanmar, it's true, but we know that the influence we have on European member states are not
strong enough. I would say one difference is we are more outspoken, we are more critical if something in Hungary doesn't go like it. Hungary has agreed in the European agreements, treaties, also in Poland. We have a court system, so there are some sanctions. But sanctions, for instance, that's impossible or even unthinkable within ASEAN.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And I think, but please correct me, that ASEAN still decide to expel Myanmar, or am I wrong?
There are discussions.
Okay.
There are really discussions, which I was surprised, but I don't think it goes anywhere. One of the formats, and that was already discussed 10, 15 years ago, I think that makes sense. As I said, there's always a consensual decision making. But if a country severely violates the basic principles, or if there's a coup, there were really thoughts, okay, then we should be able to discuss the situation in this country and maybe think of some kind of sanctions or whatever. But of course, if the member sits on the table, like in the United Security Council, it's
won't
impossible.
Accept to.
So this format, would some colleagues thought about it and labeled this format 9+1. So this means, in case there is a talk about Myanmar within ASEAN, the Myanmar delegations has to leave the room, and the other 9 discuss and may be able to find the consensus.
Okay, and it's interesting also to note that there, like you said, there are not really strong democracies in ASEAN.
Yes.
So much complicated questions. Let's go back to great power rivalries. We have explained. You have explained us that ASEAN members at its origins were like more pro-Western in the realm of the Cold War. Does it mean that they are like more pro-US in the context of the US-China rivalry, or no?
So thanks for the question. Now I could really talk for hours.
Yes,
because that's also currently my main research area. So for the Southeast Asian nations, the situation is very difficult because they have in their region, they have a great power rivalry.
China.
They have China, they have US.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they have the US-led alliance system. We have Japan, a strong actor, South Korea, Australia, India. They all play a major role as security. US is still the security provider, number one, in this part of the world. But the other countries also have security agreements with many Southeast Asian countries. So we have the security dimension. But then on the other side, we have the economic dimension. And as for many or most countries in the world, China is the main trade partner for the Southeast Asian countries. It's interestingly, it's not the top investor, despite the Belt and Road Initiative. So usually the Western countries, of course, the EU combined is very strong, but US, Japan are the key investors.
Okay.
For the Southeast Asian countries, so far they have been quite successful with their policy, we call it internationally, hedging strategies. So which means, not like in neoliberalism, usually have the choice, you either sideline with a great power or form a counter-alliance against, so bandwagoning or balancing. Hedging is a combination of both. It's a mix. And for the Southeast Asian countries, the key strategic challenge is to further signal their strategic ambiguity. So not to sideline with China or the US, so really try to cooperate with both, to reap benefits from both, but also use the other or partners, so that's omnidirectional relations, to try to become not dependent economically or security-wise on one of these nations.
And on this point, ASEAN shows again its utility, because having a place when you can go together and talk about those issues is, I guess, really useful.
That's very useful. It's first of all useful for the Southeast Asian governments, and then also ASEAN, and I think that's really something we have to highlight. In the 1990s, ASEAN did not only deepen its own integration in Southeast Asia, but it managed to establish trans-regional institutions. Mm-hmm. So now we talk about the Indo-Pacific, and if you look at the member states, yes, they truly reflect the Indo-Pacific. We have the ASEAN Regional Forum that was established in 1995, and it's up to date. It's the largest security forum in the world, because why? China's member, US is, EU is member, Russia's member as well. So we do have the key players in this part, in this forum. We have the ASEAN Plus 3 that was established in 1997 to deal with the Asian financial crisis. So that's Southeast Asia plus China, Japan, and South Korea. Mm-hmm. And we also have, since the early 2000s, the East Asia Forum. So this was mentioned a couple of times in the last week, because that's the meeting forum for the head of states. So usually the US president visits, Biden didn't show up, also Trump didn't show up in the last year, which was regarded very negatively in Southeast
Asia.
Obama was really behind this initiative. Trump really neglected the multilateral forum. So there was a strong criticism, not only in Southeast Asia, on this approach. So ASEAN has really established security, political, economic platforms for the Indo-Pacific countries to come together. And yeah, they have proven very, very useful. I mean, so far they have not been able to resolve conflicts, but at least it's a forum where head of states, senior diplomats
can meet, discuss it,
sometimes behind closed doors. And this has been so far useful. And well, I think that's really a big success. We haven't seen a war in Southeast Asia. The last one was 1979, and that was the border war between China and Vietnam. But since then, even despite all the tensions in the South China Sea, there's been no major military confrontation.
Okay, great. And my last question will be, is there and what are the relations between ASEAN and the EU? Since EU is like a model, or is it really, but it's like the real comparison to make. So is there relations between those two institutions?
The relations between EU and ASEAN, they're actually quite close. So just a few months ago, ASEAN and EU signed a strategic partnership. Yes, yeah, so they really deepened also their formal, their official relations. But the relations goes back to the early 70s, because the policy of the EU, or formerly European Community, has always been also to really promote regional cooperation in other parts of the world. Because the EU, it's always easier for the EU to talk to a regional organization than like 50 yes. African states or the 11 Southeast Asian nations, so much easier. So there was technical support, so financial also support, then a very structured political dialogue, really so many exchange mechanisms. So there were also talks about a free trade agreement between EU and ASEAN. I still believe it makes sense. However, in the last year, the talks are really stalled. One problem is the high EU standards.
Yes.
Human rights, of course, social rights, environmental rights. And, well, I don't have to mention, or listeners know it, it's the palm oil issue, Malaysia, yeah. Indonesia, that's seen very critical by European consumers. So this is really an obstacle. So far, the EU only managed to sign two free trade agreements with Southeast Asian nations, that's Singapore and Vietnam.
Okay. Thank you so much, Alfred Gersel, because I think you gave our listeners the key elements to understand and now maybe follow the actuality of the ASEAN. So they will be grateful for years to you. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It was really, really a pleasure talking about a very important part of the world.
So thank you so much.
All the best. Also, all the best to your listeners.
Thank you. Thank you.